Imagine a stage in 1964. A young girl from rural Jamaica stands before a microphone in a London studio. Her voice is high and bright and full of a promise she does not yet understand. Millie Small is about to give the world My Boy Lollipop. It will sell 7 million copies. It will put the sound of our islands on the global map before the world even knows the word reggae. But behind the curtain, the story is different. While the men of the era are hailed as architects and prophets of a new sound, the women are often treated as temporary guests. They are the backup singers and the session players who disappear when the lights go up. We call this our music, but for decades the microphone was a gatekeeper. To understand the history of the Caribbean is to hear the voices that were forced to fight for air. This is the story of the sound and the silence. The recording studios of Kingston in the early 1960s were hot and cramped and strictly managed by a masculine hierarchy. If you were a woman entering the Federal Record Center or Studio One, you were likely there to provide a harmony or a sweetening of the track. The foundation of ska and rocksteady was built on the backs of session musicians who worked for a flat fee and a bottle of stout. For the women, the stakes were higher and the rewards were thinner. They were expected to be the decorative front for a business run by men who saw music as a battlefield. In this era, the sound was a tool for national identity and decolonization. We were screaming for our freedom from the British Crown, but inside the studio walls, the old structures of control remained. A woman with a voice was a commodity to be managed, rather than an artist to be respected. In Trinidad, the calypso tents were the heart of the social commentary. This was where the news was told, and the politicians were shamed. But the tents were a male sanctuary. The language of calypso was rooted in the boast and the verbal duel. It was a culture of the midnight robber and the pyro grenade, where masculinity was the primary currency. Women like Calypso Rose had to fight for the right to even step onto the stage. She was told that calypso was not a place for a lady. She was told that her voice did not have the weight to carry the message of the people. When she traveled, she often had to change in makeshift closets because there were no dressing rooms for women. The marginalization was physical and it was systemic. We must ask ourselves if a movement built on liberation from colonialism can truly be free if it ignores the strength of half its people. The tents were full of fire, but the women were still standing in the rain outside. By the time the 1970s arrived, the tempo slowed down into the heavy heartbeat of roots reggae. This was the era of the Rasta prophet and the rebel soldier. The imagery was dominated by the patriarch. The women were often cast as the Queen Omega or the silent mother of the nation. They were the I3s standing behind Bob Marley. Their voices were essential to the spiritual depth of the music, but they were framed as supporters of the vision rather than the visionaries themselves. Even when a woman found success, the industry had a way of isolating her. Millie Small had the world at her feet, but she ended her life in relative obscurity, while the men she paved the way for became immortal icons. The industry took the sweetness of the melody and left the artist with the bitter dregs of the contract. The session hierarchy was a wall that few could climb. If you were a female musician, your technical skill was often dismissed as a novelty. The drum and the bass were considered masculine domains of power and vibration. A woman was allowed to sing about love or heartbreak, but she was rarely allowed to speak on the politics of the street or the economics of the ghetto. This created a fractured history where the feminine perspective on the struggle for independence was scrubbed from the lead vocals. We hear the history of the men who fought the law, but we rarely hear the history of the women who kept the families together while the law was breaking down the doors. The music was a mirror of the society, and the mirror was cracked. The first destabilizing turn was the realization that the revolution had a glass ceiling. The tension in the air was not just about the music, it was about the ownership of the narrative. In the late 70s, the sound systems began to grow in power. These were massive walls of speakers that turned the streets into a theater of war. The selector and the DJ were the kings of this new world. It was a space of raw energy and competition. If a woman wanted to hold the microphone, she had to be twice as loud and 10 times as tough. She had to navigate a crowd that was primed for male aggression. The stakes were no longer just about a hit record on the radio. The stakes were about survival in a space that was designed to exclude you. As the decade closed, the sound began to shift again, and the pressure on the female voice reached a breaking point. The stage was set for a reversal that no one saw coming. The shift into the 1980s brought a digital revolution and a new hardness to the sound. This was the birth of dancehall. The music became faster, and the lyrics became more explicit. We call this the era of slackness. It was a time of intense creative energy, but also a time of deep polarization. The bad man trope became the dominant identity. To be a man in the dance hall was to project a persona of absolute dominance and sexual prowess. This environment created a trap for female performers. To succeed, they often had to adopt the same aggressive language as their male counterparts. They had to play the game of hypermasculinity, just to be heard over the bass. It was a reversal of the spiritual themes of the previous decade, and it left little room for nuance. One woman who managed to cut through the noise was Sister Nancy. In 1982, she recorded Bam Bam. It is perhaps one of the most sampled songs in the history of Caribbean music. Her voice is unmistakable as she asserts her right to the microphone. But for decades, she did not see a cent from the international success of that track. While the world was dancing to her voice in movies and commercials, she was working a regular job in another country. The struggle for publishing rights is a recurring theme in our history. The industry saw a female voice as a free resource to be mined and sold. When the music becomes a weapon for the marginalized man, we must ask who pays the price for his power. Often it was the women who provided the hooks that made the songs famous, while the business moved on without them. The sound system culture also saw the emergence of the female selector. These were women who took control of the turntables and the crates of vinyl. They were the ones who decided what the people would hear. This was a direct challenge to the masculine monopoly on technology and taste. To be a selector was to be an engineer of the vibe. It required a deep knowledge of the catalog and an iron will to control a rowdy crowd. But even as they gained respect, they were often treated as anomalies. The industry liked to market them as lady selectors, as if their gender was a genre in itself. They were fighting a war on two fronts. They were fighting the classism of the wider society and the sexism of their own community. The hypersexualization of the dancehall stage became a double-edged sword. For some performers, it was a form of empowerment and a reclamation of the body. They used the stage to express a level of freedom that was denied to them in the domestic sphere. But for the industry, it was an opportunity for exploitation. The imagery of the dancehall queen was sold to the world as a spectacle of the exotic. The depth of the artistry was often buried under the weight of the visual. The complications were sharpening. As the music reached a global audience, the women were being packaged as products, rather than being promoted as producers of the culture. The midpoint turn was a realization that visibility did not always equal victory. In the 90s, the rise of the Gully and Gaza era in Jamaica intensified the divide. The music was tied to political factions and neighborhood loyalties. The violence in the lyrics became a reality in the streets. Women in this space were often caught in the crossfire. They were the subjects of the songs, but they were rarely the authors of the piece. The bad man culture required a subordinate woman to validate its power. If a female artist stepped outside of that role, she faced immediate backlash. The risks were rising for anyone who dared to challenge the status quo. The trap was set. To stay relevant, you had to feed the beast, and the beast was hungry for conflict. The digital age changed the map again. As we moved into the 21st century, the sound of the Caribbean merged with the streets of New York and the clubs of Puerto Rico. This was the birth of reggaeton. It was a hybrid of reggae and hip-hop and Latin rhythms. In the beginning, it was just as male-dominated as the scenes that came before it. The lyrics were often criticized for being derogatory toward women. But then came Ivy Queen. She stood on the stage and told the men that she was the one who wore the crown. She used the same aggressive flow to demand respect. She proved that a woman could dominate the most masculine genre in the world on her own terms. But even she had to fight against an industry that wanted to mold her into a more conventional pop star. Today, the struggle has moved to the digital front line. Independent artists are using social media and streaming platforms to bypass the old gatekeepers. They are building their own brands and managing their own publishing. They are creating music that explores queer identity and gender fluidity in ways that would have been impossible 30 years ago. The fallout from the Gully and Gaza era has led to a new generation of artists who are more interested in social justice than neighborhood wars. They are using our history as a foundation for a new kind of resistance. But the global market is a hungry machine. It wants the rhythm, but it often wants to strip away the politics. The cost of this journey is visible in the lives of those who came before. We see it in the court cases for unpaid royalties. We see it in the stories of artists who were discarded once they were no longer young or profitable. The community impact is clear. When we marginalize the female voice, we lose half of our story. We lose the songs of the domestic struggle, and the prayers of the grandmother, and the defiance of the daughter. Does visibility in a global market mean the end of marginalization, or just a more profitable cage? We are more visible than ever, but the ownership of our sound is still a battleground. The final line of this history has not been written yet, because the music is still playing. Our history is not just a collection of dates and names. It is a vibration that connects the past to the present. When you hear the bass in the street today, remember the women who had to shout just to be heard. Remember the ones who paved the road and were left behind in the dust. The legacy of Caribbean music is a legacy of survival. It is the sound of a people who refused to be silenced, even when the world turned the volume down. We are still here, and we are still singing. The pressure is still on, but the voice is getting stronger. The question is no longer if they will hear us, but if they are ready for what we have to say.